by calling and making a pledge. If you have never supported the station before financially in the past, we hope that you would take the opportunity right now to do that. The number for you to call is 244-9455. There are some very nice volunteers who are waiting to take the call. It'll take a moment or two, and it's very important to the future of this station. I was happened to be listening over the weekend to the program This American Life, and Ira, the host of the show, was talking with somebody who was an expert on public radio fundraising, and he said that they had discovered that it took between 5 and 7 years of public radio listening before someone who was willing to support the station. Now, I know there are people who are listening this morning who have been listening for more than 5 years or 7 years, maybe even more. If you've been listening for a long time and you're not a friend, a supporter, we hope that you would right now give us a call, 244-9455, and show your support for this radio station. Because after all, that's where the energy, that's where the energy comes that keeps the place strong. Well, we're also pleased to welcome back here to the program a fellow who's been with us before. His name is Robert Harvey. He is a cartoon historian, also has been a cartoonist himself. He's the author of a number of books, one, The Art of the Funnies and Aesthetic History, another, The Art of the Comic Book, and there are others besides that, books that take a look at the history of the newspaper comic strip, history of the comic book as an art form. He's also written some books about particular cartoonists. And if you're interested in cartoons and cartooning, you should go out to the bookstore, to the library, and look for Bob's books, because I think that you will find them very interesting. And he is a guy that knows an awful lot about both these subjects, more than anybody I've ever met. So if you're interested in asking questions, you want to talk about your favorites, or whatever you'd like to talk about that has to do with cartoons and cartooning, you can call in and come here to the show. No one will grab you on the way and shake you down for a pledge. Of course, we hope people will pledge, but you don't have to do that to call. If you want to call in, it's the same as always, same deal as always, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here again.
Well, I'm glad to be here, David. Thank you for having me aboard.
And I guess part of the reason is you called up the other day and said, hey, you guys, it's Cartoon Appreciation Week.
There you go.
Wouldn't it be a good time to talk about that? And somebody said, well, yeah, in fact. Now, I'm sure this was something that some cartoonist cooked up.
Yes. Cartoon Appreciation Week. There's no question that the cartoonist cooked it up. In fact, it was cooked up by the National Cartoonist Society probably about 10 years ago. And they picked what is roughly the first week in May, because in the middle of that week, or sometime in that period, is May 5th. May 5th is Cartoonist Day, and they picked May 5th as Cartoonist Day because that's the day in 1895 that the first full-color cartoon of the Yellow Kid appeared in the New York World. And the Yellow Kid is often cited as the first American comic strip. The Yellow Kid was not the first American comic strip. It wasn't a comic strip. It was a big humorous drawing. Didn't take the strip form at all, and it wasn't first. But it was very successful commercially. It sold newspapers on the corners of New York streets like nobody's business. So it established the newspaper cartoon as a commercial entity that newspaper editors should take advantage of in order to increase their circulation. So the week in May that embraces May 5th is Cartoon Appreciation Week. And this year it is the second today through next Sunday. And as it happens, for the first time, it also embraces what's called Free Comic Book Day. On Saturday, you can go to either one of the local comic book stores, and they have a vast supply of comic books that they're going to give away for free.
Pretty good deal.
It's a way of introducing a new reading public to a literary form that has matured a great deal in the past 10 or 15 years, and about which most people still think is a sort of juvenile trash, but it's actually achieved a great deal of maturity in recent years, and it's worth a look. Mm-hmm.
That is something that might surprise people if what they're thinking of is the comics of their youth. But the fact is that now we even have a new term for it. We call it now a graphic novel.
Yes.
To perhaps get across the idea that the verbal content, the story part, is more advanced, and also the quality of the artwork is more advanced.
The term graphic novel actually applies to what some people call the long form comic book. And a typical comic book is 32 or 40 pages, something like that, and the story is about 20 or 22 pages long. The rest of it's advertising, but so that's the comic book. But if you take and quadruple the number of pages, so you're looking at 100 pages or 300 pages, then they prefer to use the term graphic novel. The term was actually invented in the 60s by a fan of comics who felt that comic book was not an adequate term. And, of course, he was right, because comic books are very often not comic, they're not humorous, and they're not books. So what are they? And he decided graphic novel was a good alternative. Originally, he applied it to comic books because there were no long-form comic books at that time. And then later on, 10 years or so later, we began having these long-form books drawn as comics. And the term graphic novel began to be applied to almost any kind of comic book that had hard covers.
There are some places where they have real big comic cultures, and I guess the place that I really think of first and foremost is Japan, where a wide range of comics, manga, is the Japanese word, are produced.
Yeah.
And there are some that clearly are for children, and there are some that clearly are adults because they have high levels of violence, and some of them are, in fact, flat out pornographic. So there's very wide range of stuff. And so that there is a fairly significant adult readership of these kind of things in Japan.
Yeah. And the manga in Japan, they look like New York City phone books. I mean, they're huge, voluminous tomes. People read them going on the high-speed trains back and forth to wherever their place of work is. And they read them very rapidly. There isn't much verbal content in these things. And they can read, I don't know, I read a statistic on it one time, which I've forgotten, but in order for the statistic to be true, you have to imagine somebody holding this book in his hand and turning the pages almost as fast as he can. That's how quickly they read them. Hmm. That may be why they're so big, why they have so many pages.
has comic reading in the United States penetrated that much into the older age ranges, or is it pretty much still we're talking about people who are under, say, 18 years old?
Well, I think that there are now a good deal more people over 18 who are reading comic books and graphic novels than there used to be. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can find American English translations of these manga books in bookstores, Borders and Barnes & Noble, places like that. They have now 20 or 30 or 40 feet of bookshelves devoted to these. One of the things that the publishers, the American publishers of Japanese manga have discovered is that manga translated into English, there's a particular genre of manga in Japan that's written with a teenage girl in mind as a reader. And those have been translated and marketed in this country with great success, reaching a female audience that, for the most part, has ignored comic books throughout most of the history of that medium.
Yeah. I guess that's true. I suppose I would think of it primarily. Maybe this is my childhood experience, that was a comic books are a boys' thing.
Yeah.
And that I suppose that there are comics that have been created here in the United States. There are comics that have been created with the idea that girls would read them. But it doesn't strike me as being something that particularly would have been a thing that girls would have done.
No. And I don't know why that is. Back in the 50s and maybe in the 40s, there was a comic book called Katie Keene. And the big feature in Katie Keene was that the costumes that this girl wore were designed by the readers of the comic book. And you'd read in the fine print under each picture of her different costume who designed it and where they lived. That was a big, exciting thing, but I don't think it started a big readership comic books by teenage girls. Not even the Archie comics. My girls, when they were growing up, they read Archie comics, but that was about the only ones they were interested in.
Well, questions are certainly welcome here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Harvey. He's a cartoon historian and has authored a number of books looking at the history of the comic book and of the comic strip as published in the newspaper. He's also written about particular cartoonists and knows an awful lot about the subject, both the state of the art as it is and what has been in the past. So questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the things I thought you might have a little something to say about is the maybe generally is the comic book or comic strip as inspiration for film. And, you know, we've talked about this before. And this is the kind of thing that this is not new. This is not new at all. I guess I think about it, though, just because recently there has been yet another movie based on, I think, probably what deserves the status of the graphic novel, Frank Miller's Sin
yes.
City,
right.
Where, in fact, the person who created the movie went to some lengths to try to reproduce the look of the comic in the film. So it has a very stark, it's mostly black and white
yes.
with some very bold swatches of color, you know,
yeah.
pasted in,
yeah.
and really tried pretty hard, I guess, to make the movie look like the
yeah.
comic.
He was. I think they were very successful. What was his name? Robert Rodriguez, I
yes,
think.
Yes.
And he forfeited his membership in the Directors Guild because he wanted Frank Miller, the cartoonist who created the graphic novels that the movie was based on, wanted him to give him credit as co-director. And the Directors Guild didn't approve of that, so Rodriguez just dropped his membership and made Frank Miller co-director anyway. The comic book or the graphic novel that Miller did was used virtually as the storyboard for the movie. And it was a startling success if you are to measure the success by the extent, by the fidelity of the movie to the visual images of the comic book. Frank Miller's Sin City comic book, when it first started, it looked to me as if he was having just a great deal of fun trying to obliterate as much of every one of his drawings as he could with heavy black solid ink so that you would look at a picture in his graphic novel and you would see white's highlights. Instead of seeing a whole figure, you would see a figure that would be almost solid black because it was standing with its back to the light source, for example. And for the first two or three issues of this graphic novel, he just got progressively darker and darker or blacker and blacker as he ladled in the ink. It was a kind of a fun game to see just how much he could obliterate and still have enough visual left to tell the story. Well, he's subsequently backed away a little bit from that, and he's varied the texture of his drawings a little bit and so on. But in the meantime, he still has produced a startling black-and-white imagery, and it was that which Rodriguez and he reproduced on the screen. And it was very successful in that respect. And, of course, that's what the reviewers landed on. They regarded the movie as a work of art rather than as a narrative adventure.
Mm-hmm. And I expect that there were some that who actually failed it on that point, who said, well, it may be interesting to look at and may be faithful to the style of the artist who created it. But aside from that, I think a lot of people said, I don't think this is a particularly great movie.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think I think that there were a lot of people who thought that. Mm. It was a very fragmented narrative because it was pieced together out of three separate stories from Frank Miller's work.
Hmm. I think we have a caller here we're getting ready to include in the program. And again, I just want to make sure the people who are listening know that here on Focus, we welcome your questions and comments, like always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. And I think we have someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Can I go ahead with the question?
Yeah, sure.
I've got a question about Classics Illustrated Comics. You know, they used to have them years ago, and they were just wonderful. But they went out of print, then they would come back as little booklets. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get them because I teach Spanish, and they were in many different languages.
Huh.
They're just wonderful for teaching foreign languages.
I suppose you're right. They're not published anymore, of course.
Well, not...
And if you try to find them, you could probably find them... individual titles for sale on the internet one way or another.
Right, but they're very expensive, I think.
Yes, you're going to pay a collector's fee for them. There was a comic book publishing company about 15 years ago that tried to produce modern versions of classic comics. I'm trying to remember the name of the company. I think it was called First Publishing or something like that. And they did four or five of them. They were very good. And they were the production values were much higher than the classic comics of, or classic illustrated, I think they were called, of the 1940s. They were produced on slick paper with high production values, and the coloring was painted rather than flat overlay like the Sunday Funnies. But they're not out there anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately. Where can one find out information about the history of them? You know, when I was in Norway, I used them to learn Norwegian.
Oh,
great!
Gee whiz. Well, it's funny. You mentioned that when I was in the Navy 40 years ago, there was a good constituent of the Navy that came from the Philippines, mm-hmm. and because of the special relationship between the United States and the Philippines at the time, why they could serve in the Navy, and they all served in. The officers' wardrooms, and they studied for advancement. They were given, because they didn't speak English all that way, their textbooks for studying for advancement were all comic books. The irony is that when they took tests, the tests were regular multiple-choice tests. They weren't comic books at all. So,
no. So basically, you just cannot give me a reference on a history of these Classics Illustrated or who the guys were who did it. I thought they were really well done.
Yeah, well, great.
But you don't have any reference.
I think the best thing is to check the internet. There are probably a couple of books out there on Classics Illustrated, and the comic book, what's it called, Price Guide, which is a fat paperback that comes out once a year. It has a section on Classics Illustrated.
Okay, good. Well, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I guess here we're talking about things like comic book versions of The Three Musketeers,
yes,
or
yeah.
Classics of world literature, Moby Dick, I don't know, Les Mis, I don't know if those things were made into comic, but that sort of thing. And probably if you're of the right age, you indeed will remember these things. And so that they don't exist anymore.
No. And you'd think there'd be a market. And, of course, this First Comics outfit gambled on that and didn't make it. I was talking about the quality of the reproduction of comic books. They're all much higher now than they were back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s when they were four-color pulp magazines. They're now almost all printed on slick paper. The color is applied either by watercoloring so that it's like a painting, or it's done by computer. So you have shaded color with... tonal variations and different hues of the same colors and so on. It's very elegant coloring. Sometimes the quality of the artwork exceeds the quality of the stories, but that's maybe the way it should be in a visual medium. I don't know.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else in Champaign. This is line two.
Hello. Hi there.
Yes.
Interesting subject.
Mm-hmm.
Two quick questions. Do you know where I could get copies of old Mandrake the Magician comic strips? It used to be in the Sunday News Gazette.
Yeah. Oh, boy. No, I don't. About in the 60s, somebody produced a little magazine that reprinted a few a sequence of Mandrake the Magician, but he hasn't been widely reprinted. And apart from getting newspaper clips of the strips, which is the only way I can think of other than to find a book that reprints some substantial portion of the continuity, apart from that, that's I don't know of any other way to lay your hands on it. And I don't know either any sources of comic strip clippings. Let's see. There's an outfit in California called Starland, and you could look that up on the computer, I think, or on the internet. And they have quite a library of clipped comic strips and old newspaper comic sections, and they probably have some Mandrake the Magician.
Well, that'd be fun. I'll try that. Second question is, any possibility that Calvin and Hobbes will ever come back?
The syndicate that sold Calvin and Hobbes, Universal Press, they periodically, I suppose once every 6 months, they ask Bill Watterson if he's going to come back, and he steadfastly refuses. You might be interested to know, though, that in September they're going to publish the complete Calvin and Hobbes. They're going to reprint all 10 years of the strip in a 2 or 3 volume slipcased edition like they did the Far Side a year or so ago.
Well, that's good to know. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, we'll be happy to take some other questions here for our guest, cartoon historian Bob Harvey, in a second here. Jack Brighton has slipped back into the studio, and once again, we want to take a moment here to remind you just how important your financial support is for WILR Radio. As I think I said a little bit earlier, one of the things that I really enjoy about doing the program here on public radio is I can have these long, luxurious conversations with people and don't have to take any breaks. Not breaks for commercials, not breaks for anything. And that is really a great luxury. And only in public radio do you get a chance to do that. Certainly you can't do that in commercial radio. But if we can't do that if not for the support of listeners. That's sort of the bottom line. Jack Brighton is our producer emeritus, Focus 580, still right, substituting as host and as a guy nowadays who is really in charge of our presence on the internet.
I guess I'll mention the phone number to begin with.
Good idea.
Pledge, please call with your pledge right now. That's what we have to get you to do this week, 244-9455. Do it right now on this Monday morning to make us feel really good and get things really rolling, too. And, you know, it's funny because you use the word luxury in describing the time that you have to spend talking with guests. And it's really true. There's really nowhere else on the dial, on television, on radio. I mean, where else can you actually do that? I mean, public radio is the only place where that happens. And the public radio model is that, we ask people to voluntarily chip in. Instead of sending you a bill, we don't send you the cable bill or the phone bill. We don't have a bill that we can just send you. But we do have to come on the air every once in a while, a couple times a year, and ask you to make a phone call, 217-244-9455, to make a pledge to help us keep this thing going. Because after all, it's only a luxury if, there is no way to pay for it. I mean, we have to pay the bills. So please do your part right now. You're a listener to the show. We ask you to keep it going. 217-244-9455. And Maeve Riley is our patterns editor in our Pledge Center. We had a few calls earlier, but what's going on now?
Well, the phones are a little bit quiet right now, so we'd like to hear from a few folks. Let me give you a suggested level to give us a call at. How about $40? That's our basic membership level that entitles you to Patterns, our monthly programming guide, and also helps provide support for these great programs like Focus 580. We also have a special going on now. If you're a student or on a fixed income, you can chip in $12.50. That's half of a senior or a student membership. And Bill and Nancy McDonald will chip in the other $12.50, and then you'll become a friend of WILL and get the program guide as well. So give us a call, 217-244-9455.
All right. Thanks very much. We'll talk with you both again at the end of the program. Once again, I should introduce our guest, Robert Harvey. He's a cartoon historian. He's been writing about cartooning ever since the early 70s, has been a freelance cartoonist himself and has worked in all of the cartooning venues, comic strips, editorial cartoons, comic books, and magazine cartoons. He's a member of a lot of the cartooning societies, including the National Cartoonist Society. He's authored several books that look at the history of cartoons and cartooning. And let me just mention three titles: The Art of the Funnies and Aesthetic History, The Art of the Comic Book, same subtitle, and also one, Children of the Yellow Kid. So one way or another, the books look at the history of the comic strip as it appears in the newspaper, also of the comic book. And he has a website as well. If you're a comic aficionado or you're interested in keeping up on what's happening with this art form, you can take a look at his website, which is rcharvey.com. And
I might,
yes.
Do we have another caller?
We do have a couple callers.
Good.
Let me give you the telephone number again, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. To the phones here once again. We have someone in Champaign. They are next, line one.
Hello. Hi.
Yeah.
I tuned in a little bit late, so I'm not sure if you mentioned it, but have you ever seen a copy of The Miraculous Journey of Muhammad, the Miraj Nama?
Say that again.
Have you ever seen a copy of The Miraculous Journey of Muhammad, also known as the Miraj Nama?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's like an Eastern Turkish comic book that came out in, like, I think it was the 1400s.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
And it is based on a translation. Well, it's a translation of the Miraj Nama, which was translated into Latin and French, and which is probably the source of Dante's Divine Comedy.
My goodness. No, I haven't heard of it.
Really
thanks.
Cool. Hmm.
I wish I had.
Well, you probably can still get one on the used book market. It's called The Miraculous Journey of Muhammad.
Okay.
And give you the ISBN if you want.
What?
The
ISBN, yeah, would you?
08076-08688.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Well, that gets at one of the questions I was thinking about asking earlier, was what would anybody say was the earliest example of a comic book? It sounds like maybe that might be it.
Well, that's what is it? The answer to that question always depends on how you define a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start almost endless discussions with people like me by approaching it from the point of view of what is it? You know, and define it, and so on. I think of cartooning or comics generally as being a species of pictorial narrative, and a lot of children's books are pictorial narrative. Pictorial narrative can be wordless pictures that tell stories. They can be pictures that are accompanied by text beneath them, which describes most children's books. But in my view, pictorial narratives do not become comics until the words move into the picture frame. And usually that happens when the words, when speech balloons appear and words start appearing in speech balloons. Generally speaking, in my view, comics are those pictorial narratives which blend words and pictures to make a kind of sense that neither the words nor the pictures make alone without the other.
Hmm.
And that distinguishes comics from other kinds of pictorial narratives. Now, this Miraculous Journey of Muhammad, is that the name of that?
I think that's what's going
on. Okay. I haven't seen that, so I have no idea. But it sounds like it's very old. There are a lot of pictorial narratives that go back hundreds and thousands of years. So the medium is scarcely new if you think of pictorial narrative as the general category under which comics fall.
Hmm. Well, when was the first speech balloon? When does the first speech balloon appear?
Oh, my. I don't know. They have appeared as early as, you could find them in the cartoons of James Gilray, 1780s or 1790s in that period. You can find them before then, I'm sure, in isolated instances. The modern use of the speech balloon, in which the balloon appeared as a little bit more elaborately constructed visual device than just a puff of smoke coming out of somebody's mouth, started about 1900 in a comic strip called Happy Hooligan. And I like to think that's the first modern use of the speech balloon. It's a matter of convenience. It's like saying the first motion picture is the one that they charged admission prices for. And there are film students who say that. You know, I mean, it's a convenient benchmark to distinguish movies as a experimental phenomenon from movies as a commercial enterprise. So by the same token, I say the modern comic strip began with Happy Hooligan and speech balloons.
Right. Well, let's talk with some other people here. Let's talk with someone in Indiana on our toll-free line, line four, right here. Hello.
Hello. Since you come on, I was sort of reminiscing. I stopped reading comic books. I think it's around eight. So this means that the comic book I'm asking about is from the 40s for sure. And all I can remember is the fellow would recite a formula. And within the formula, I know it was the square root sign, but at the time I was 6 and 7, I didn't know that, and it really mesmerized me. I remember going outside sneakily and trying to repeat it to see if all of a sudden I could run 6,000 miles an hour. And I was wondering if you happen to know the name of that character. I don't even know if it was a full comic book. It may have been one of those comic books that had two or three different stories within it. I just thought perhaps you might be able to come off the top of your head who that was.
Well, it sounds like the Flash. I think he achieved high speed by reciting a formula.
Yeah, okay, well, doesn't ring any bells at all, but that's the fellow, undoubtedly. Yeah,
Do you remember what he looked like? Did he have a Mercury uniform on?
I just vaguely remember, you know, and it's just sort of like anecdotal information. I vaguely remember him having regular clothes. And when he said the formula, he had a different set of clothes, you know, some kind of, I guess, Flash.
Yeah. Well, he was a high-speed superhero. That was his power, was fast. It was speed.
Yeah. And he could, you know, poor Superman could outrun bullets, but he could go faster. And
stuff.
Okay, well, thanks. I'll try looking that up on the Internet, because that just sort of brings back some old memories from the old days, for sure. Okay. And that's about it.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on here. We have someone listening in Flora, Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Harvey. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
I wonder if you would comment on one of my very favorite artists who's relatively new, and one of the works that he did that I just think blows me away, and that is Alex Ross and a work that he did called Kingdom Come.
Alex Ross.
Alex Ross, yes.
Okay. He's the guy that does full-painted comics, if I remember.
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know very much about him, except that he's probably the most successful of the people who try to paint comics. The difficulty with painting comics is that you don't use outlining black lines to contain the color. So you have to be a very accomplished artist in order to draw pictures with full color and no outlines and still have the smallest versions of these pictures be decipherable by a reader. But he's awfully good at it, and he's done four or five graphic novel kinds of things, two or three of them. One of them was about Superman, one about Batman, one about Wonder Woman. I've forgotten the names of the individual ones, but of the individual titles. But each one of them celebrates that character. He's awfully good. He uses real models for these characters so that he can draw them, draw the faces in different from different points of view and still retain the recognizable features.
Well, I'm kind of an amateur artist, and what amazes me is I look at one of the panels on just one of the pages, and I think, my gosh, it'd take me a month.
Right.
To sit down and do this. And this guy is doing basically a full volume of work that, you know, is page after page after page. And what I was wondering is, how long does it take somebody with his type of talent to do a graphic novel, which is effectively four books?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can estimate, of course. But I would think that he probably works on two or three pages at the same time. bringing each one of them up to various stages of completion as he goes. So it's a real production-conscious effort. He has to produce this material over a period of very short time, relatively speaking. But I don't know how long he takes. I know that he does it faster than you think, because he couldn't produce this kind of work if every individual panel were being treated like the Mona Lisa or something.
Well, I often said that if I had his talent without his speed, I probably would spend a lifetime trying to put together just what one of his works is, because it blows me away.
Yeah.
That and if you're aware of any of it, that the attention to detail in some of the panels, it almost looks like a photograph, especially when he works in the light and the shading. And you look at it and you say, my gosh, it almost looks like somebody did photography.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay,
well, thank you. Other questions are welcome. We're talking here this morning in this part of Focus with cartoon historian Robert Harvey. You have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455.
I might say a word or two about editorial cartooning, which is undergoing one of its periodic periods of crisis. There are, well, editorial cartoonists, generally speaking, believe that they're an endangered species and that their number is steadily decreasing. And in fact, that's probably true. At one time, the turn of the last century, that is when we got to be 1900, there were a lot more daily newspapers, and most of them, many of them, had a staff editorial cartoonist. In fact, they had several artists on staff because half-tone photography had not, or half-tone pictures had not achieved any kind of universal representation in newspapers, and so the only visuals were produced by artists. And frequently those visuals included editorial cartooning or political cartoons. So there were probably, at the turn of the century, there were something like 2,200 daily newspapers, and there were probably at least every other one of them had a staff cartoonist who did editorial cartooning. But that was in an environment that was quite different. When you get to the 1950s, many authorities believe there were somewhere around 270 or 300 editorial cartoonists. That is, people who worked full-time drawing editorial cartoons for the editorial page of a newspaper. In the late 1990s, someone did a careful counting and came up with about 150. And today we're down to about 100. The reason for this evaporation, there are a couple of them. One of them is that the number of daily newspapers is steadily shrinking. And the other one is that editorial cartoonists, many of them are now syndicated. So an editorial page editor in a newspaper, like at the News Gazette, can subscribe to a syndicate service and get five or six editorial cartoons every day from which he can pick ones to run in his paper. If he had a staff editorial cartoonist, he'd have to take whatever that guy did. And he'd be paying him more than he pays the weekly fee for the syndicated service. So it was a combination of happenings, many of them essentially economic, that has resulted in the steady decline of this particular breed of cartoonist, which is too bad when you consider that we are in many respects in the most visual-oriented age that we've been in. And yet one of the principal practitioners of a visual art, the editorial cartoonist, finds himself on the verge of extinction.
Hmm. I'm sure that there are people find a lot of things in the newspaper that irks them, and cartoons can be one of them. Actually, even people can get annoyed by the joke-a-day strips, depending on what those people do. But editorial cartoons, by their nature, are designed to provoke. They're designed to be irksome. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is something that you have some thoughts about. How many complaints newspapers get about their editorial cartoons? And does that influence whether or not editors say, do I want to have cartoons at
yes,
all?
Yeah, I think it does. Editors get more complaints about editorial cartoons if the cartoons are about local topics. Mm. So they, even if they have a full-time cartoonist on board, they discourage that cartoonist from drawing on local topics because that just makes the telephone ring. So if they don't want cartoons on local topics, they may as well be taking syndicated cartoonists because they always draw just on national topics. I'm sure that editors are very conscious of the newspaper editors are very conscious of the kinds of disturbance that an editorial cartoon can create. And, of course, every disturbance is a testimony to the power of the editorial cartoon. Mm-hmm.
We have a couple of callers here and a little time remaining, so let's see if we can get everybody in. First in line is a caller in Champaign in line one.
Hello.
Yes.
My name is Ruben, and I come from South America. It's been very pleasant to listen to you guys this morning. I have a question for you. I don't know if there's actually any cartoon similar to Mafalda. I don't know if you're familiar with Mafalda. Mafalda is a very famous South American cartoon written and drawn by Kino in Argentina, which has a very political character. I haven't been able to find anything like that in American cartoons. And I also wanted to ask if you could comment a little bit about Asterix and Obelix.
I don't know the cartoons that you're talking about. Would you say the name again?
Mafalda.
Is that the name of a cartoonist?
No, the cartoonist is Kino. Mafalda is actually the product. It's been drawn by Kino. It's very famous in South America, and I think also in Europe, in Southern Europe. And then Asterix and Obelix is actually French. It's drawn by a French drawer. I think it is Urdesso who drives it, Albert Urdesso.
Hmm. No, I'm not familiar with it, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was basically trying to find something in American cartoons of the same sort, but I haven't been able to find it at all.
Something that has a lot of political content and political commentary?
Mafalda has a very smooth political content, and she became kind of a hero for a generation during the dictatorship and afterwards. And she comments a lot on political matters from a perspective of a child. Whereas Asterix actually doesn't have too many cartoons, but the cartoon notebooks or the books that they've drawn for the last 20, 30 years are very limited. There are probably 13 or 14 copies of them, and still it describes a lot of the adventures of a Gaulish guy.
There's a South American cartoonist, a woman, whose name I think is Matina, something like that. And there have been three volumes of her cartoons that have been published in this country. They're all called Women on the Edge, and it's Women on the Edge 1, Women on the Edge 2, Women on the Edge 3. They're very good and highly satirical from a feminine point of view, and they're just marvelous things. I hadn't seen anything like it for a long, long time, but they're great. Great cartoons, very funny and very insightful. She's been urged to capitalize on her popularity and do animated programs and various other things, but she's resisted all of that, saying, in effect, why should I give myself all the extra work? I'm having fun now. But I don't know that there are any things being produced now that would be as highly political as you are suggesting, unless you talk about comic strips like The Boondocks and Doonesbury, which periodically publish collections of the strips in book form.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's talk with someone in Charleston there next, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I just started listening, so maybe you talked about this earlier, but what's the difference between a comic book, which I used to read as a kid, and what you're calling graphic novels now?
Okay, the definition or the description that I made earlier was that a graphic novel is a long-form comic book, which means that it has more pages than the average comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are published between hardcovers or paperback rather than magazine covers. You can make other distinctions, but you eventually get defeated by the complexity of the definition. I think a long-form comic book is probably good. It implies that the story is longer and that the story was actually drawn for book publication rather than serial publication in a series of comic books.
Do they have a main character that...
Usually, yeah.
The way comic books did?
Well, they may not have a main character that continues from one graphic novel to another, but within the graphic novel, within that particular title, they would have a main character. One of them recently, for example, is called Clyde Fans, but Clyde is not the name of the character. And it's about two brothers that own and operate a fan manufacturing concern in the 50s or 60s that has slowly gone out of business. And it's about the personalities of these two characters.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we'll go to hear somebody on the cell phone, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Question I have is, me and my brother used to collect a lot of comic books when we were still in high school, and right about now we're at that age where we're considering selling them. And what I'm looking for is some personal advice on how we would go about getting a good value out of the comics that we'd spent so much time on.
Well, I guess I'd refer to the Internet as a place that you could go. You could sell them individually on eBay, and you'd probably get more money for them on a auction basis, individual titles, if you wanted to spend the time, than you would trying to sell a collection. Other than that, you could take your whole collection or samples of it to a comic book store and ask them if they'd be interested. And if they weren't, they could probably refer you to somebody who would be able to help you.
And one of the other things that I noticed is that when I was actually buying the books when we were still in high school, they seemed like they actually had a decent value. And now with the movies coming out, it actually seems like the values are going down instead of up.
Oh, I'm not aware of that. I think the value is going up.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks and good luck. And probably for anybody who was really interested in finding out what the current state of comic art is, and they're interested in looking at some graphic novels, there are places where they sell them, where they specialize in that. So you could go and seek that place out, and you can go in. And they probably wouldn't mind if you came in and looked around and looked at what there was and asked some questions. And sure. After all, as you mentioned in the beginning, we're coming up on Free Comic Day.
Free Comic Book Day, Saturday, right?
Just as a part of, we talked a little bit in the beginning about this was Comic Appreciation Week. And they have declared Free Comic Book Day. And the deal is, so says Bob, that you can go into a comic store and they will give you a free comic.
Well, you might actually get more than one. There are publishers who produce titles expressly for distribution on Free Comic Book Day.
Oh, all right.
So you can't go in and take any comic book that's in the store, but you can take from the supply of specially produced comics for the occasion.
That's the idea. All right. Well, we're about the point here where, for this time around, we will have to stop with the promise that I'm sure Bob will come back maybe a little later this summer, and we'll talk some more. It's always fun to have you here. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
R.C. Harvey, Robert Harvey, he's a cartoon historian. If you're interested in sampling some of his work, you can look for his books, The Art of the Funnies, The Art of the Comic Book, Children of the Yellow Kid. He also has a website that's devoted to a discussion of comic art, and that is rcharvey.com, so you can check that out. And every once in a while, he's here on the program, and we talk about comics, and we always have a good time. Programs here on this station are made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM580. And we hope you will. And you can do that right now. It's easy. It's quick. It won't take more than a minute or two. And here's what you do. You pick up the telephone and you dial 244-9455. That's the number to call to make a pledge. And then someone picks up the phone and says, hello there. And then they ask you who you are and what your address is and how much you'd like to give. And that's about it. And you come away with a good feeling that comes with knowing that you actually support a service that you value. Jack Brighton is here in studio with us. He's the guy who's our web guy. People can actually pledge on the website, can't
Absolutely
they?
Absolutely right. Yeah. In fact, a lot of people have been pledging on the web. A lot of people listening outside of our coverage area on the broadcast channels pledge online, and the web address, will.uiuc.edu. There's a pledge link on the top of every single web page on our website. How'd that happen? And so you just click that, and you can pledge by credit card, or actually there's a form if you'd like to, have payroll deduction or whatever other way that you would prefer. So please use that. Or you can call the pledge line, 217-244-9455. And, as we have observed in the past, we don't want to become a cartoon character in a cartoon graveyard.
You didn't write that, did you?
No, indeed. I just kind of appropriated it for, perhaps, inappropriate use here. But what I want to say—
I don't find this stuff amusing anymore. That's my problem.
Well, just call me Al. Okay. Anyway— But whatever you call me at the pledge line, 217-244-9455. Make that pledge now. We know our audience has been growing. This is one of the things, the success stories of public radio has been that the audience continues to grow. And I think it's because of the programming, quite frankly. People are finding that, actual radio programs are disappearing from the radio dial elsewhere, and they're discovering that we're actually still doing radio here. So if you just recently discovered the station, you are especially important to us because we have to keep our membership base growing. Again, the pledge line, 217-244-9455. Do we have time to check in with
Yes, I think we do.
Okay,
we talked to Maeve.
Yes,
in
I'm here.
Pledge Central. She is the editor of Patterns, our program guide, and that's one of the benefits of membership in the Friends of WILO. Anybody who makes a contribution of $40 or above will every month receive a copy of Patterns, and so you will know what's happening on our radio stations and on our TV station.
That's right.
And Maeve is the person who's responsible for that publication.
That's right, and I'd like to say thanks to two folks who've given us a call already, Glenda Lane from Champaign and Dallas Jackson from Urbana. Thanks very much for giving us a call. If you haven't called yet, now's the time to do so, 217-244-9455. Make a pledge at the $40 level and receive Patterns and feel good about supporting public broadcasting.
We also haven't mentioned the member card this morning, which is something that you get at the $75 pledge level. It's a card that gets you 2-for-1 discounts at a whole bunch of restaurants in this area, and actually throughout the United States, and actually more than just restaurants, because there's retail shops that give you discounts and so forth. So you actually save money if you contribute $75 to WILL and get the member card.
That's right. And we don't find this stuff amusing anymore. Go to the phone, call 217-244-9455 and support WILL.
All right. Well, we'll make way here for the staff of the Afternoon Magazine. There will be news, weather, sports, an opportunity to call in today with questions about nutrition. Celeste Quinn is the host of the show.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up this afternoon in 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will talk with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She'll join us to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise. I'll invite your questions for Susan following the 1 o'clock news. Then later this afternoon, sound designer, composer, and Prairie Home Companion performer Fred Newman will join us to tell us how to whistle, pop, boing, and honk. That will follow the closing market report this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. May wheat, 312, down 6. July.